Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster, along with my friend Ray Allen. Ray is engineering and producing our show today, and together we welcome you. It is the Buckmaster Show, midweek edition, April 26, 2017. The winds have settled down at least for a day or so, which will help firefighters try to get a better hand on the fire south of Tucson. We're coming to you from Tucson's Voice, AM 1030, live streaming at buckmastershow.com and kvoi.com. We have all of our podcasts and pretty much every show we've done over the past 6 years with the radio project. That's available for you at buckmastershow.com. We're going to be talking about cybersecurity in the first half hour. If you'd like to join in the conversation on a very important topic, if you've got some questions or comments, 790-2040, the live line number. Well, the threat of cyber warfare has replaced terrorism as this nation's number one threat. That, according to former CIA Director John Brennan. Director Brennan warns we face a potential cyber Pearl Harbor. Joining us on the Buckmaster Show live line to discuss the current and future state of cybered conflict is Dr. Chris Demchak, the Grace M. Hopper Chair of Cybersecurity and Director of the Center for Cyber Conflict Studies in the Strategic Research Department of the U.S. Naval War College in Rhode Island. Dr. Demchak will be here in Tucson on May the 9th to address the Tucson Committee on Foreign Relations. That's a nonprofit organization that for 52 years has brought some outstanding first-rate speakers to our community to address the most pressing problems in international relations. Dr. Demchak emphasizes the comments she is about to present here on my program are her own and do not reflect the policy of the United States government or the Department of Navy. Dr. Demchak, how are you?
I'm fine. Hello.
Good to talk with you again. What is, in your opinion, give us kind of the broad definition when we're talking about cyberspace. What is it?
People mistakenly call it a domain. That's really an administrative term. It's helpful. But the best way to think about cyberspace is that it's a substrate. It's the connectivity, content, and sometimes it's called cognition, that is now connecting all of our major functions in the society. It's more than your telephone and way more than your bank account and other things as well.
So is cybered conflict the same thing as cyber war?
No, it isn't. One of the ways you want to think about it is this substrate, this cyberspace, was built on the Internet, and it was built extraordinarily poorly. It was built very fast, very cheap, a lot of holes left in the programming, because when they built it in the 90s, they thought it didn't matter. It didn't connect anything terribly important. And then they spread it on e-commerce around the world, and the consequences have been that it has doubled the amount of complex system surprises that every society faces. And the last two layers are composed of a huge population of criminal bad actors that reach through these holes that were left in the programming, right, and reach right into the critical societal functions, your banks, the intellectual property of firms, and they remove it. And because they do that, because they are capable of doing that, you find that governments are also figuring out how to do that. And you end up with this spectrum between peace all the way through war of these amount of bad actors, and I also have a small group called wicked actors that are really skilled and really hard to find, who can remove, if you will, the value from your society without you actually knowing it. And you can be in a conflict with another state, not even being aware that your economic lifeblood is being sort of hollowed out. The former commander of U.S. Cyber Command called it the greatest transfer of wealth in human history. And it goes on long before you get to war. this kind of conflict. And that's what we call cybered conflict. Just as a side note, it's fundamentally different in five ways from the way we used to fight wars. Before, in order to conduct a war, you had to be either an emperor or a close neighbor to be able to afford what you needed. Now, you can be 5,000 to 5,000 miles away, and you can organize an offensive army or botnet for nearly nothing, the scale of which is really up to you. Secondly, you can be that far away, we call that proximity, and you can collect all the information that we used to consider top secret information with hardly any effort, mostly time. Thirdly, you can choose amongst an amazing array of tools. You can start them on one person or one town or one area. You can go away for lunch. You can say, oh, that didn't work, try again. Fourthly, you can hide those tools. In fact, you are encouraged to hide those tools because if someone knows about the tools, they can go to the international cybercrime market and buy a tool to stop your tool. And fifthly, you can hide who you are. And you want to do that because you are also on this incredibly complex, shoddily built substrate, and you don't want someone coming back at you. So with the five, the scale, proximity, precision, deception, and opaqueness, you have a new kind of conflict, and one that doesn't wait for us to go, we're in war now, or let's launch the bombers. One that happens long before then, and for most adversaries, it's in their interest to hollow you out long before you consider, throwing a missile at them.
All right, let's go to the live line. Caller Jim, I believe it's our friend Jim Kelly, would like to join in the conversation with Dr. Demchak. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Bill. Dr. Demchak, how does cloud computing relate to cyber warfare, and is it more secure, and how does it secure information within the context of cyber warfare? And I have a follow-up.
The one thing you want to think about is cloud computing. Is cloud computing is a solution to a fundamental question. Am I more secure if I have central control over all of the various actions that other people can take? Or am I more secure as a large-scale system if I've dispersed my system into smaller chunks that any enemy or adversary or thief has to go to each separate chunk in order to get something from you? Now, the answer is that people have given with cloud computing is because the cloud, it's cloud is a misnomer, of course. It's really huge data banks, right, big server farms and so on. The answer is if they have it and you go and buy time on their servers, then they will control all of the aspects of it that would otherwise cost you time. They would centrally control your security, and they would then be able to keep adversaries from sneaking in on the inside and stealing your data and so on. The drawback, of course, is that what we've seen over time is the criminals and the adversaries do what we call moving up the stack. They go, right, well, then I'm not going to just attack you. I'm going to attack the firm that's running your cloud, and I'm going to compromise them. And when I do that, I'm going to get everybody, whereas before they would have had to go firm by firm by firm. That is the downside of standardization. It's great for efficiencies. It's great for profit-making. It's great for pushing things out quickly and rapidly. But efficiency also means you're not particularly redundant, and that means that you offer what we call a target plane that's quite narrow. I'll go right in where everything has to connect. That's the disadvantage of cloud computing.
Jim, you had a quick follow-up?
I do have a quick follow-up. Have you ever had any interaction with Vice Admiral Janet Tighe at Cyber Warfare Command? And
I have.
If you have, tell her hello from Jim Kelly. We flew together back in the war.
I will, of course.
All right. Dr. Chris Demchak is with us on the Buckmaster Show Live Line. So much to discuss here concerning cyberspace. How much time do we have to get this together? It's great to be thinking about it, but that time frame is quickly narrowing, isn't it?
Yes. My argument is cyberspace, is now about 20, 25 years old. And the bulk of that time, particularly in our democratic civil societies, not in the outside world, we've been acting as though we just need to persuade the outside world to stop attacking us. It'll all get better. It hasn't. And the difficulty is there is a rising technological skill in the outside in sort of the non-consolidated democratic civil societies. And they are very interested in our wealth and not particularly interested in our democratic rule of law and civil society. So we don't have much time to figure out how to respond. And in several pieces that I'm working on, I'm arguing we have got to have a cyber resilience alliance amongst ourselves to preserve what's left, what will be left of the open internet. Another thing that's happening is the rise of the rest of the world is authoritarianism is rising as well. And for other people, the internet is not going to be the open, free place that we have. And as they rise and their internet becomes fragmented and controlled, it will be very hard for us to keep selling to them the technologies that keep an open internet. And that means that in the long run, we've got to defend our own.
All right, we're going to take a break right here. Dr. Chris Demchak sticks around. We'll talk more about some of these huge, huge issues facing the United States in trying to deal with the growing threat out in the cyber world. We'll be right back on the Buckmaster Show.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com.
At the Pima County Public Library, we are powering possibilities. Every day, in person and online, we help you connect, learn, create, and achieve your dreams. Come browse our shelves or take a class, pursue your passion, and connect with others. Do you dream big? We do. Anything is possible at your local library. Call 791-4010 or visit library.pima.gov to be inspired today.
This is Bill Buckmaster. One of my passions is travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. When I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport, with six airlines flying nonstop to 19 destinations and easy one-stop connections I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient, with competitive airfares, and the best part is there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Check out flytucson.com, travel smart, and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. On a changing planet, the University of Arizona's Biosphere 2 has been diving deeper and looking closer while energizing, innovating, conserving, and advancing science on an unparalleled scale to better understand the natural systems around us and to inspire our future generations. For 10 years now, UA Biosphere 2 has explored our planet's future. Come, explore it yourself. Open daily, biosphere2.org.
Are you a landlord by choice or by force? Experiencing a job transfer and don't know what to do with your current house? Want to move but can't sell your current house? Hello, my name is Ken Adams, co-owner of Rincon Ventures Property Management. Rincon Ventures has a fully automated accounting process, electronic payments, and 24-hour access to your accounts. With some of the lowest rates in Tucson, Rincon Ventures has grown rapidly in this down economy. Let us show you why. Give us a call at 881-2258 right now and experience the difference. Rincon Ventures, where service is a fact, not another empty promise. 881-2258.
It's a land and cruise vacation sale at Bon Voyage Travel. Plan your dream vacation now and save big, up to 65%. Alaska, Hawaii, Europe, South America, the Caribbean. Pick your perfect destination. Bon Voyage Travel will create your exclusive getaway that includes extra perks and bonuses you won't find anywhere else. Call Bon Voyage Travel today or visit bvtravel.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Coming up Thursday, the former United States ambassador to Turkey, he'll weigh in on an area that is of increasing concern to this country. Also, Pima County Superintendent of Schools, Dustin Williams. Buckmaster on AM 1030 KVOI with worldwide live listening, our podcasts, and show archive on my website, buckmastershow.com. Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show. We're talking about the threat of cyber warfare on our live line from Rhode Island. Dr. Chris Demchak, who is going to be in Tucson May 9th addressing the Tucson Committee on Foreign Relations. Dr. Demchak is a chair of cybersecurity and director of the Center for Cyber Conflict Studies in the Strategic Research Department of the U.S. Naval War College. Dr. Demchak, the Pentagon created a cyber command. How long ago was that, and is it considered doing what it should be doing to protect Americans from this threat?
The Cyber Command was created in 2000. Well, it was set up in 2009 and fully operational in 2010. It's specifically, its job is to protect the military grid. However, the most interesting thing about it is it is dual-hatted with the National Security Agency, and with that amazing signals and cyber capability in the NSA, the Cyber Command, of course, is now got the capabilities unparalleled, well, at least for the moment, in the world to reach out and touch an adversary. The difficulty the Cyber Command faces is the scale of the adversaries are overwhelming. And, of course, you have a rising China that it fully intend to be a cyber power. The other difficulty they face, and this was expressed by General Alexander in first took the job, the first commander. First 6 months, he said, I'm defending the grid. The next 12 months, he goes, wait a minute, it's about the critical infrastructure. And by 18 months into the job, he and his staff were running around, hair on fire, going, it's the whole economy.
It's everything.
And it could see, and the way our laws are written, they couldn't tell these people. They could hint, you should look at your data there, you know. But they could see the extractions, the massive IP thefts going across the country as they, and they're always looking outward, but they watch things go in and go out on foreign, basically on foreign connections. And they could see what the Chinese were doing and the Russians were doing and the Iranians were doing and a whole host of other people. And they go, oh, my God, it's just leaving. So one of the difficulties we have is our definition of cyber power. It seems to be tied to a cyber command. Well, properly, though, because it's a substrate, it's actually our power rests on how resilient our society is, as well as the ability of a cyber command to reach out and forward disrupt an adversary. And the difficulty a lot of people have is they think the cyber command is doing everything for us.
Right.
It simply cannot. And the private sector is left completely off the list. DHS is not responsible for the private sector. It's responsible for the government, and it can't tell anybody in the private sector to pretty much do anything. And so when you have a major number of private sector actors more interested in their quarterly returns and they don't want to pay for it or they don't want to believe it's true, then you leave a country vulnerable. And one of the things I'm working on now is how do we get an alliance with them and across our like-minded countries to make this resilience? We can chase someone down. It's actually, attribution is not as hard as we think it is. If you have the capabilities of an NSA, you can chase someone down. When they're 100,000 to someone's or 50,000 or 10,000, it's extremely difficult to chase them down. And that's where resilience comes in.
We've had these attacks on e-commerce, but we really, I don't know, what about a national security attack? Has there been anything like that in the United States so far?
Well, at the moment, remember we're in the field, we're in the spectrum of cyber conflict where it's the period in which you really want to hinder or cripple or hollow out someone. So we have, for example, the massive theft of the personal data of people who work for DOD in the OPM hack. And, you know, what is that data going to be used for? Well, at the moment, we don't have a specific attack to go, oh, that's where that data was used. But if I were China, I'd be sitting on it going, okay, these guys are carrying the code for nuclear weapons, and let's go see who's traveling there, and let's just do a big data search on all that big, lovely data we have and see who's gone, to China, or to Japan. These kinds of things happen all the time. DOD, Defense Department, is attacked all the time by everyone, and sometimes they get through. When you talk about a major cyber attack, you have to ask, what do you mean by attack? Has anybody been killed that we know of? Mm-hmm. Not directly. Have they destroyed anything that we know of in a public sector? Not particularly. Do we have a number of adversaries who are gathering up the data and laying an incident, we call it preparation of the battlefield, so that if they wanted to, they could? Yes. And what is keeping or staying their hand? Well, what is it they want to get? What's the point when they want to do it is when we're going to see, you know, how they use it. And if you want to look at what cyber conflict looks like when it gets towards the shooting end of the war, you can look at the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Because there you have Russia flowing from taking apart banks or electrical grids into enabling missiles against the Ukrainians, tracking Ukrainian cell phones of Ukrainian soldiers in order to drop bombs on where those soldiers are, following their Facebook entries so they can go find them and later kill them, etc. So you see the Russians in what they call their hybrid warfare moving fully up and down the spectrum of cyber conflict. Every piece of information they collect, they store, and then they turn around and use. And they do kill people.
You know, there is this line, and it's fascinating. You've got the line separating a cyber attacks from a traditional act of war. And then, you know, what is a nation's response to something like that? I mean, with an act of war in the traditional sense, we know what to do. But in this case, not so much.
Exactly. And you know, at the end of the day, there are a lot of conversations about, we have a red line, we've got to have this red line, got to have that red line. And fully, I mean, this part, cyber hasn't changed. Red lines were always and will always be ultimately a political decision. Until the day comes that, you know, I send you a code of 647 and your automatic system just fires back at me with no human involved, it will always be a political decision. A good example is the Sony hack. A lot of large American firms have been hacked, a lot of them. And in principle, Sony wasn't a major U.S. national interest. But it was a political decision from a lot of frustrated people to say, okay, enough already. And they, you know, the U.S. government said, fine, this was done by North Korea. Here it is. No question about it. And so on. That was a political decision. My expectation is that will be absolutely the point at which we say, this is a cyber attack. You've gone too far. Here's what we're going to do.
Time is running out again.
Yes, time is running out, particularly for us to be resilient. China is a rising cyber hegemon, absolutely, absolutely no holds barred. They like to bribe a lot their way in. It's building the 4G networks all across Africa. The vast majority of people in Africa use their cell phones. So when you make your cellular network, and it is paid for, they're almost free, these networks, for these African leaders. And it's paid for, run by Huawei, which is a Chinese state champion. run by Chinese people. That means that data is flowing through China, coming back out. And I've posed this question, what are you going to do when it looks like Ghana is attacking us in cyberspace? And you go to Ghana, and poor little Ghana says, oh, just a minute. And they call their Huawei representative who says, there are no irregularities here. And what do you do? I mean, you know? And Huawei is in deeply into the major enterprise-wide system of our Fortune 2000. The German company SAP, a major private sector company that does enterprise-wide data management. I mean, they're phenomenally good at it, and they've done it for some number of years, is now using this Chinese firm's major cloud-based data warehouse program called HANA. The HANA, by the way, stands for Huawei. Why it doesn't say Huawei is because Huawei knows people are suspicious about Huawei. So they changed the name and they put it HANA. And now SAP stated its entire future rests on their using this HANA system, which is throughout the world's Fortune 500 firms. The same firms who seem to have more difficulty in markets and seem to be losing a lot of their intellectual property. One doesn't have to be a rocket scientist to put the link together.
Dr. Chris Demchak, great to reconnect with you. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Chris Demchak, the chair of cybersecurity and director of the Center for Cyber Conflict Studies in the Strategic Research Department of the U.S. Naval War College. She will be coming to Tucson May 9th to address the Tucson Committee on Foreign Relations. We'll be right back. The Regional Transportation Authority and its members are working together to deliver transportation improvements to our region. More than 770 improvements have been completed to date. The success of the RTA is built upon collaboration and leadership that focuses on addressing our regional mobility needs to make our region a safer, more efficient, and more vibrant place to live. Better roads, better transit, better choices, a better future. More at rtamobility.com.
At the Pima County Public Library, we are powering possibilities. Every day, in person and online, we help you connect, learn, create, and achieve your dreams. Come browse our shelves or take a class, pursue your passion, and connect with others. Do you dream big? We do. Anything is possible at your local library. Call 791-4010 or visit library.pima.gov to be inspired today.
Southern Arizona is home to one of the world's most trusted sources of information on medicines. The Credible Meds website is visited each day by over 2,000 people from more than 60 countries. You too can learn how to personalize your medications and take control of your health care. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and join Bill Buckmaster each month as he and Dr. Ray Woosley, founder of Credible Meds, give you practical tips on how to get the most from your medications.
As a small business owner, I know the importance of a certified public accountant you can trust. That's why I recommend my CPA, Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates, proud sponsors of the Buckmaster Show. Located at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com or follow the live link on buckmastershow.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The excitement is building for the grand opening in 2017 for the Twisted Tandoor. The legendary Indian food truck will now have a permanent brick-and-mortar home at Swan and Camp Lowell Drive. The menu will be an expansion of the Indian classic offerings from the original Twisted Tandoor food truck. The Twisted Tandoor, coming in 2017 at 4660 East Camp Lowell Drive. On a changing planet, the University of Arizona's Biosphere 2 has been diving deeper and looking closer while energizing, innovating, conserving, and advancing science on an unparalleled scale to better understand the natural systems around us and to inspire our future generations. For 10 years now, UA Biosphere 2 has explored our planet's future. Come, explore it yourself. Open daily, biosphere2.org. This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com. And Green Things, one of our fine sponsors, have a couple of free workshops coming up Friday afternoon at 1 and then Saturday morning at 10. The Friday afternoon workshop has to do with irrigation. And then I think Saturday morning they're doing some more of those little fairy garden displays that look so beautiful around the house or outside in the garden. Green Things, 3384 East River Road. Jan and Jack, the owners over there, please say hello to them when you go by. Just west of the intersection of Dodge and River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, greenthingsaz.com. Let's go back now on the Buckmaster Show live line. On the live line, Dr. David Garcia, ASU Professor of Education, who is formally into the race as a Democrat for Arizona governor. Dr. Garcia, how are you?
I'm doing well, Bill. How are you?
Very good. The last we talked with you was during your run when you ran for superintendent of public instruction, narrowly losing to Diane Douglas. But now you are in the race for governor. Why, Dr. Garcia?
Well, I know last time you talked to me, we had a long, lengthy conversation about public education, about my commitment to public education. And even though it looks like lots of things have changed in many ways, though, they're all the same. I jumped into this race because of my commitment to public education and because I am just done with what's been happening at the state level with respect to the commitment to public education on behalf of the governor and the legislature.
This governor says he is the education governor, Dr. Garcia.
That's good. Well, look, here's the situation. What happened was a couple of weeks ago, he signed a voucher expansion bill. Not only did he sign the bill, he pushed for the passage of the bill. And as a public school parent, and I think this is an important part, I am choosing to send my daughters to public schools. And as a result, I believe that being ranked 50th in the country and taking more money out of public education is an insult, and it is not honoring my choice to be in a public school. That's not my definition of an education governor.
Did the voucher, the so-called vouchers, and I know that some people pushing for the enhancement, they call them educational enhancements, really believe that is the way of the future of education in this state? Obviously, you disagree.
Oh, absolutely. Look, the legislature's responsibility is to maintain a system of public schools. Our framers understood, I think we understand, I understand well, that the path going forward has always been public schools. I don't believe that the legislature owes me a debit card. I believe the legislature owes public school parents a school, and it's a very different perspective. And it is a school that I am fighting for. It's fighting for quality public schools, not just for my own students, but I think this is an issue that impacts all of Arizona. Let me give you an example. There is still really, I've not heard one credible argument on how does a voucher bill help small towns with public schools as their option.
Dr. Garcia, you cut out there. I think your cell phone cut out. If you would just rephrase that last paragraph there. Go ahead for me. Rephrase that. We lost the back end of that.
Sure. Well, it was genius. Let me tell you that.
Go ahead.
No, I think this is, to get back to that last part, I have not heard a credible argument as to how this bill helps, for example, rural Arizona. The most of Arizona where the option is public schools. And so even if you say that's the way forward, I don't think it's the way forward for the vast majority of Arizona parents.
Talk about what else is on your platform as governor. Certainly education is very important, but what else would you bring to the table?
Yeah, I think there's a few other things. We've got to look at education, starting with education, but education is really the foundation of economic development. Much of what you have seen happening, for example, in the more urban areas of Arizona, really can all be tied back to investments in higher quality workforce. I just saw, for example, a company moving to Phoenix because of a partnership with Arizona State and the human capital that's able to bring. And so even though this is a initial discussion about K-12 education, it really extends to higher education and having the kind of talented workforce available to attract higher paid and high-wage jobs to Arizona. So I think education extends well beyond just the K-12 platform. I also, as you may have heard, also just came out and said that I would be open to raising revenue, particularly for education. In that case, I think that is a broader discussion of everybody, including Arizona's corporations, et cetera, paying their fair share. And I think that's going to be another significant issue going forward. And last, because we're in Arizona, and maybe because my last name's Garcia, I think immigration is going to be another huge issue for us as a state. We have a lot to lose with the stance that the Trump administration has made with respect to Mexico and how he has really separated and I think segregated us as a state and as a country with Arizona's biggest trading partner.
Getting back to education and this teacher shortage, as governor, what would you do to make Arizona an attractive place once again for men and women to go into the field of education?
Yeah, well, I think that comes down to one thing. We need to treat teachers as professionals. And to me, that it's two major prongs. First, we need to let them teach. I believe that really one of the major reasons why we lose creative, smart folks in the classroom is because we box them in such that they're not able to be creative and smart as they're really looking for spending too much time and energy on things like passing standardized assessments. So I think that having more flexibility in the classroom for teachers to teach is the first prong to teaching them treating teachers as professionals. And second, we need to be serious about teaching as a profession and where one can live and raise a family. One of the things that I bristle every time I hear is when people thank teachers for their service. And teaching shouldn't be a service. It should be a profession. It should be regarded well enough with respect to how much we're paying teachers so that good people can stay in teaching and maintain a quality of life and raise a family.
All right, Dr. David Garcia, now a candidate for governor of Arizona, a Democrat. Where can people find out more about this campaign that is pretty much just getting off the ground, Dr. Garcia?
Just getting off the ground, but you can find us at the Nutters DG, the number 4AZ.com. That is DG4AZ.com. You can also find us at DG4AZ on Twitter and Facebook as well.
All right. Dr. Garcia, always a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
Thanks a lot. David Garcia, in it as a candidate for governor. And by the way, coming up on Friday, Senator Steve Farley, who has not officially announced, but he's certainly thinking very seriously about he would be challenging Dr. Garcia in a primary if it gets to that point. We'll talk with Farley on Friday. But next, State Senator Steve Smith after this. Tucson now has its own Creole restaurant. Capturing the spirit of New Orleans cuisine, Saz Creole Kitchen and Cocktails is located in St. Philip's Plaza at River and Campbell. The New Orleans-inspired menu includes a full range of gumbos and much-loved beignets. See you at Saz Creole Kitchen and Cocktails. Open daily, 8 a.m. to midnight at St. Philip's Plaza. This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Next time you book a flight, type in TUS. Travel smart and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100. The Regional Transportation Authority works with its member jurisdictions, the business community, project neighbors, and the broader community to deliver transportation projects promised in 2006. This collaborative effort is a model of diverse interests coming together for the benefit of the region. This spirit of regional collaboration helps us address the mobility and safety needs in all of our communities. Better roads, better transit, better choices, a better future. More at rtamobility.com.
The Southern Arizona News Examiner, reporting from a different perspective. We bring you national stories ignored by the mainstream media. Sources include the Washington Times News Service, Personal Liberty Digest, the National Center for Policy Analysis, the Washington Free Beacon, and the Heartland Institute. It is national news coverage from a different perspective. The Southern Arizona News Examiner. Free subscriptions at soaznewsx.com.
Today, more than ever, consumers want to work with a business they trust. Hi, this is Suzanne Miller with your Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona, reminding you that thousands of consumers go to tucson.bbb.org every week to inquire about trustworthy businesses. Is your business accredited with BBB? To find out more, call Celeste Angelini at 520-345-5837 or go to tucson.bbb.org and remember to always start with trust.
If you're searching for that special one-of-a-kind item, may I suggest Adobe House Antiques. It has a vast collection and variety of antiques, lighting, and fine art. In addition to the interior space, a large outdoor location offers an extensive collection of vintage patio furniture, exterior lighting, and ironwork. Come see Penny at 2700 North Campbell, 325-9439, or on the web at adobehouseantiques.com. Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley. Twelve minutes now before 1 o'clock on our midweek edition of the Buckmaster Show. This portion of the program presented by our friends over in Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. How about a road trip just 3 hours east of Tucson? So much to do over in that beautiful portion of the Southwest corner of New Mexico and the Southwest United States. Many things to do, including visiting Pinos Altos, a mining ghost town that is still thriving. Go to southwestnewmexico.org, the full listing of the many places to go and recreate in the area and great places to stay. Let's go now back to the Buckmaster Show live line. And to the state capitol we go, Republican Senator Steve Smith, representing the town of Maricopa, with us on the live line. Senator Smith, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Bill. How are you?
Doing very well. I want to talk and share with our listeners about this Blue Lives Matter bill. You were the sponsor of SP 1366, which the governor has now signed into law. Why is this needed, and what will the law do?
Well, you know, it's a pretty simple tweak to the law, but I think it's a very important one. And simple, I mean, our law kind of read this, that if you intentionally target an officer simply because they're on duty doing their job, current law says that person would get what's called an aggravating factor. So if they stood in front of a judge and a judge realized, yep, you did go after that officer just because he was an officer, they can put almost a stiffer penalty on. What was not in the law and what was missing when I read it last year, which is it did not cover officers when they're off duty. And so this bill simply just said, hey, whether an officer is technically on or off duty, it shouldn't matter. If they are targeted solely because they are a police officer, as determined by a judge in the court of law, then it shouldn't matter if they're on or off duty. And that's what this bill did. It just kind of gave the officers full protection from frankly, being hunted down, as they are in many cases that we've seen nationwide. And we thought that was an important change and clarification to make, and we made it.
Now, would the officer have to be, like, in uniform, or how would someone know this was even a police officer, Senator?
Well, that's just it. And so there's a high threshold. So, again, the judge or the court would have to determine. So let's say you did have an off-duty officer and he's walking down the street and some guy just assaults him or punches him or shoots him. If there's no correlation between his employment and the crime, then everything just stays the way it is. But if it is determined by the judge, if the evidence shows that, nope, this person, this criminal, sought that man or woman and assaulted them solely because of them being an officer, that's when the aggravator would kick in. But again, the judge and the court would have to determine that. So it's going to be, you know, somewhat of a high threshold. It's not just going to be, hey, cop, you know, off-duty cop is walking down the street and somebody punches them, now they get an aggravator. No, they had to have solely targeted them for their being an officer.
What's the reaction been to this?
Well, we had great bipartisan support on the bill. You know, the governor signed it immediately. I think the governor even said, and when he signed it, he said, this legislation sends a clear message that Arizona stands firmly behind its men and women in uniform. And he said, and I'm proud to sign it. And so we had good bipartisan support on the bill. The governor signed it. And, Bill, quite frankly, it's just protecting those that protect us. Hey, I think officers have probably the hardest job in the country today. They've got to do their job with the weight of the world and the scrutiny on them, that they have to do it perfectly. And we expect, we expect a lot of our officers, as we should. But when we see some of the things that's been happening to them nationwide lately, we just want to make sure that they can come home safe. And as a state, we want to do everything we can to ensure that.
State Senator Steve Smith with us on the live line. Let's take advantage of having you on the show today to get a legislative update. This session, I've been around a while, and I normally we get a budget by this time, don't we, Senator? It seems like we're a little late this year.
You're right. We're all kind of waiting, too.
Yeah, what's the deal?
Well, there's a sticking point in the budget. The governor is proposing to do a bonding mechanism to provide more funding to the universities for their building and maintenance and things of that sort. And a lot of members have an issue with using a 30-year bond to do that, as opposed to maybe just talk about paying it out of the budget itself. And so it's a big issue, and we want to make sure we get it right. And so that's why I think you see a little bit more of a delay to try to craft that language just right. What is that going to mean, and what is the state going to do for the universities as that relates to that specific issue. This has nothing to do with the regular university funding that they get. This is just a special bonding issue to help with building and maintenance. And so we're just trying to tighten the language up to make sure they've got the votes to do it.
And it is a huge departure from what we have expected from university funding, correct?
It is. I mean, it's a billion-dollar bond over 30 years, and so you're looking at a 30-some-odd million-dollar commitment every year. It involves their TPT, so it's like this mechanism of taking the TPT that the universities generate and turning it right back around and sending to them, and they match it. It's kind of a convoluted system, and so we just want to make sure that whatever is going to come of it, that it passes a smell test for all involved, and we'll see what happens.
Let's see if we can get a call in here for Senator Smith. We have a caller who doesn't agree with the Blue Lives Matter bill. Ingrid, go ahead.
No, I certainly don't. When people commit some kind of violent act against anybody, they've got some grievance against that person, or they're nuts and they just don't know what they're doing. You can't start saying this person's worth more than me or you, or that I'm worth more than someone else. That's totally nonsensical.
All right, let's hear what Senator Smith, how he replies to you, Ingrid. Go ahead.
Yeah, fair point, Ingrid, but I'll just tell you now, in current law, before this bill was signed, you not only had law officers protected, you have judges, you had firefighters, you have some teachers, healthcare workers, you even have code enforcement officers, park rangers. All of these professions currently exist in current state law. And so this bill did nothing more than to expand what was already in state law for officers, making it on or off duty. So nobody's really saying that certainly one life is worth more. But the idea is if you're gonna intentionally target the person because of their employment, whatever that employment might be that's listed in statute, that's when your aggravator kicked in. This is not in the hate section. So you have what's called a hate section statute, where if you target somebody because of their race or their gender or whatever it is, that's a whole nother section of law that, again, already exists. This does not go down that road, but you'd be surprised. There's already several professions covered, and we're just saying, hey, I don't care if a cop is on or off duty. I think we all know the state of affairs with law enforcement right now. We want to make sure they're protected, and that's all it does. But it doesn't value anybody's lives more than the other. It just expounds on what the current law provides, and I think it's a fair expounding of it.
How about senators easing requirements for teacher certifications? Were you on board with this one?
Well, so that was a vote that I think we just had. Maybe it might have been yesterday.
It was. Yesterday.
Yeah, and so, yep. And that had to do with especially teachers coming in from out of state. We first want to have a uniform process where if they were past the teacher's equivalency in one state, we want to make sure that we have reciprocity in place, that we can do it. But the governor spoke about this issue really quick in his State of the State address back in January. And he gave the example of this. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who's one of the most amazing women in politics ever, he said in his State of the State, said, Justice O'Connor, who was the first majority leader in the Senate woman, the first woman Supreme Court justice, has a law office building named after her, could not walk into a school and teach civics. And the governor said, you know what, I just think there's something inherently wrong with that. If you have somebody that has clear, demonstrable subject matter expertise, why should we limit who that person is or what they should do or not do? And so that bill just kind of, it relaxed some of those burdens to have people that are incredible subject matter experts come in and teach. If Bill Gates wants to come in and teach a computer class or something, he ought to be able to come in and teach it based on his expertise. However, the State Board of Education is still charged with defining effectively what all that means. So this just does not mean Bill or Senator Steve can just walk into a room and say, all right, class is in session. The State Board of Education still have to have, their fingerprints and their model around, well, how does that work? Who does qualify and how does that work? And so I think it was in line with what the governor was pushing for in the State of the State. And I think it's a, I think it's a step in the right direction to help our kids.
When do you think the budget will be first look at it? I've only got a few seconds.
Yeah, you know, we expect something next week. We've been working on it for months. We expect hopefully some movement next week, and we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okay. Senator Steve Smith, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining
us. Likewise, sir.
Thanks.
God bless you. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot. State Senator Steve Smith, a Republican from the community of Maricopa. Senator Smith's colleague in one of his colleagues in the Senate, Senator Farley, will be my guest here on the Buckmaster Show on Friday. So there's certainly going to be no shortage of things to talk about. We'll see if Senator Farley wants to take it one step further and make his announcement here on the Buckmaster Show that he is formally a Democratic candidate for governor. Maybe we'll have that on Friday. What we will have is Mic Check with Mike Shaw at 4 o'clock. Ray Allen will be with Mike, making sure everything works properly for their fine program from 4 to 5, then Wake Up Tucson 6 to 9 in the morning, and then me, Bill Buckmaster, back with you for another edition of the Buckmaster Show. Until then, on behalf of Ray Allen, I'm Bill Buckmaster. Have a great afternoon and evening.